I am Linda Smith, and I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. I'm from that place way across Georgia that Dennis was talking about, that no-name place. It's really way down yonder from here. Oh, I'm really grateful to be here this morning and to be with you. I've seen a lot of people that I knew already. I was real surprised about seeing Evelyn and some other people. I've made some new friends, and I'm just grateful to be here. I want to thank Linda and thank Jonathan and the committee and Evelyn and everybody for the opportunity to come and be with you. When I say I'm a grateful Al-Anon, there's been a lot of times in my life I was not grateful. But today I can truly say I'm a grateful Al-Anon. I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in a family with a mother, father, three sisters, and a grandmother. We went to church every Sunday, and there was no drinking in my house or around me. There was problems. There's always problems in every family, but we really had a good home life. And the older I get, the more I know that it was a good, good home life, and I'm grateful for it. I was brought up in the church, and I was taught to pray, "Thy will be done." And I prayed that way, but I didn't mean it. See, when I was growing up, and even before I ever met an alcoholic, I had a little problem with control. And I wanted things the way I wanted things. And so when I said, "Thy will be done," it was all right if God did it, but I wanted him to do it my way. And so I didn't realize I had a problem with control until I got to the program. And I will say, since all of you do that here, that I came into Al-Anon, I became an active member of Al-Anon in June of 1984, and my home group is the Waycross Al-Anon Family Group. And I don't know how they put up with me, but I have a really good group. It's the best group in the world, because they've put up with me for years now. But anyway, as I was growing up, I was the kind of child, I was a brat. I was the one that I just didn't fit in. You know, I would play with my sisters or my friends, but if they wouldn't play like I wanted to play, I just wouldn't play with them. It had to be my way. And also, when I grew up and went to school, I always felt less than. I guess our family was a middle-class family. Mother and father both worked. You know, we had what we needed. We didn't always have what we wanted. And I always wanted to be like those people that had a lot of money. They were rich, and I thought they were somebody. So I was always trying to fit in. I always wore a mask, and I didn't want anybody to see the real me. And I acted like I was better than or that I was as good as other people. But on the inside, I didn't feel that way. I felt less than and that I didn't fit in. But when I got into high school, I got in with the in crowd. I became a cheerleader. I was captain of the cheerleaders. But I was putting on a front the whole time. I didn't feel as good as the other people. I finished school, high school, and went off to college. Now, by this time, I had not drank. Because good little girls way back then didn't drink. I said that the other day, and then I realized, well, they did. They just hid it. But I didn't. I didn't drink and smoke, and I wasn't around it that much. Well, I got off to college, and of course I tried it, and I was around drinking, and it became a little bit more acceptable, you know. And then I met this guy, and he drank. But now let me tell you a little about him. He was the life of the party. And I have to be honest and say his family had money, too. And he was one of those somebodies that I liked, you know. But anyway, we started dating, and we would go to parties, and he could drink more than anybody there. And he had the money, and he could buy the drinks, and that made me feel important because I was with him. And so this went on, and we began dating. We continued to date. And I know now that his alcoholism was progressing. Even during that time that we were dating, he got where he would drink and he would pass out at parties. He was no longer the life of the party, and then I was embarrassed. So I started, even before I married him, trying to make him stop drinking. And so we got on this little trip even before we got married. Well, we dated 7 years. Now, I tell you, I had a little bit of problem with control. I found out when I got in this program that ego means easing God out. I have a little problem with ego, so it's always I did this, I did that. Well, I decided we needed to get married. But you see, I always had this in my mind that I was going to meet this knight in shining armor. He was going to ride up on his white horse. We were going to get married, have a little white house with a picket fence, two children, and live happily ever after. And also in the movies, see, he's supposed to get down on his knees and propose to me. Well, we dated, and I kept waiting, and I kept waiting. Well, 7 years went by, and he didn't do that. So I told him it was time, and we got married. He never did learn to play his role right. All those years. Well, by this time, I knew there was a problem. I had a problem with his drinking by the time we got married. I knew nothing about alcoholism, but I knew that he loved me so much that when we got married, he'd quit drinking. No. We got married and the drinking got worse. And the more he drank, the more I tried to make him stop drinking. And the more I tried to make him stop drinking, the more he drank. So we got on what I like to call the merry-go-round, and it went faster and faster. I would do all the things I was listening to Ernest last night and thinking about some of the things he was saying about his dear wife. But I was thinking I would nag, I would whine, I would scream, I would holler, I would pour out his liquor, I'd go buy him more liquor, I'd try to love him to death, I'd try everything I could to make him stop drinking, and nothing worked. Well, we'd been married about a year and a half, and the drinking was really progressing. He had a sister that was in the hospital in another town, and I decided we needed to go see her. She had a 2-year-old son that I kept a lot, so we get up one Saturday morning and get in the car, and we're going to see his sister, and I'm taking her 2-year-old. Well, my husband always drank wherever he went. He always took an ice chest full of beer, and he hunted, so he always had guns around, too. Well, that morning, he took his several guns, and he cleaned them on the way up there and reloaded them. And he drank his beer, and we headed out. The little boy was in the front seat, and we headed out to this town to see his sister. We got there, and we went in to visit. And I was trying to visit his sister, tend to the 2-year-old, and my husband got away from me. See, by this time, I was already into the games of watching him, keeping the keys from him. He had DUIs. He had had a DUI even before I married him, but he kept getting DUIs. He was an habitual violator, so he never had any license. And I always drove, just like driving up there, and I used to say that I drove because he didn't have any license, but I know today if he had had any license, I'd driven anyway because I thought I could do it better. But anyway, we were up there, and we were visiting, and he left. Well, he came back later, and it was time to go, but we had not eaten, so I got the 2-year-old and my husband, and we left, and we went to a Hardee's, and we were sitting in there. I took the child in. My husband said, I just don't want to go in. I'm going to sit in the car. He said, leave me the keys, and I did, and I took the 2-year-old in, and we were eating, and I looked out the window, and there goes my husband. He's leaving, and I just left the 2-year-old sitting there. He had not pulled out into the traffic, and I ran out and somehow got the car turned off, got him out of the front seat into the back, ran back in and got the 2-year-old and headed out of the town. Well, I had seen my husband drunk a lot, but I'd never seen him quite like he was that day. It was as if he didn't know who he was, where he was, who I was, or what was going on. He was talking really weird. So we're driving. I'm trying to drive, tend to the 2-year-old. My husband's in the back seat. And I reach back, you know, trying to make him see that everything, see, I can handle anything. So if I can just make him understand that I'm in charge, that everything's okay, then he'll be okay. Well, he grabs my arm, and he almost breaks it, and I finally get it back. And we head on out, and we get out of town a little ways, and he said, stop at that liquor store. You see, I know now that, and I knew by the time I got in the car, that when he left at the hospital, he had gone to get some vodka. And he had been drinking, and he was very drunk. But anyway, he said, stop at that liquor store. And I said, no, can't do that. I've got to get this child home. Well, he pulled a loaded gun on me, and he said, I said, stop, and I stopped. I have never been so scared in all my life. And I thought, what am I going to do? I was praying. I was talking, I was trying to get him to understand it was me, because I knew he wouldn't hurt me. And I didn't know what to do. And about that time, some friends of ours from our hometown had been to see his sister, and they recognized the car and thought we had car trouble, and they pulled over. And when they did, he threw the gun down. And the husband of that couple got in the car and rode with me, and the wife took the little boy in her car. And somehow, by the grace of God, we got home. And I want to talk about the fear. I had had fears, of course, in my life, but never a physical fear like that. And what I did with that fear, it stuffed it down inside. I thought, I can't tell anybody. See, I was 28 years old before I married him. And we'd only been married a little over a year. And that night, when I finally got him to sleep, got the two-year-old to sleep, I stayed awake all night. And I laid there, scared to death. And I put this brain to work, and I thought, okay, what can I do about this? But see, I didn't think I could get out of that marriage. All my friends were married and having families, and I had chosen him. And I thought that if I got out of the marriage, that I would be a failure. So I thought, I can't get out of the marriage. So what I've got to do is make him stop drinking. And so I decided to redouble my efforts, and I was going to make him stop. Well, the next morning he woke up, and I truly believe today that he was in a blackout and that he did not remember any of that. We got up, and I told him everything in detail. And after I did, he promised me that he would not drink again, and it was something like Ernie said last night, I don't believe that he ever intended to drink again. I believe he meant that promise with all his heart, but he didn't know how not to drink. And so in a few days, he was drinking again. But that fear that I'm talking about, I just pushed inside, and I thought, I can't tell anybody this. I never can tell anybody what happened. So we're going along, and I'm trying really hard now to make him stop drinking. I would pour his liquor out, then I'd go buy him some more, because I didn't want him driving. He had all those DUIs, and I was afraid he was going to kill somebody or get killed, so I was doing these kind of things, and I was preaching to him. I tell you, I'm not proud of this. He would get up, he would come in, he'd pass out on the couch. He was real quiet. He wasn't loud. He wasn't violent. That's the only time he ever held a gun on me. I'm not proud of this, but I was the violent one. I was the one that screamed and hollered and hit things and hit him. And I'm not proud of that today. But I would be so frustrated. But there was one thing I did that he would be passed out on the couch, and I'd wait till he slept it off a little bit. Then I'd sit on the edge of the couch and trap him. I had him. Now, he had to listen to my lecture now. And he'd have a hangover, and he'd feel so bad. But I was going to make sure he heard what he needed to hear and how to get sober. I knew nothing about getting sober. But we're getting sicker and sicker, and there was this minister that I would talk to, and I finally told him about what had happened with the guns. And, of course, I had already been talking to him about the alcoholism, and about the drinking, and he happened to know a little bit about alcoholism. He knew about treatment centers. And so in November of 1977, when I was talking to him, my husband was getting worse. He was having some liver damage, and things were just really bad. So the preacher and I convinced my husband that he needed to go to treatment. And so we took him to treatment for the first time in 77. Now, he is gone for the cure. And he's going to come home, and when he gets home, we're going to get that little white house with a picket fence and those two children, and we're going to live happily ever after. But while he was gone to treatment, I was actually 12-stepped. These two Al-Anons, I used to say heard about him, but today I know they knew about me. See, I didn't think anything was wrong with me. It was all his fault. That's what I thought at the time. But anyway, they came to my house, they brought literature, they talked to me, told me about themselves, they invited me to a meeting. And so I'm a good little wife now. He's gone for the cure, but I'm going to go to my first Al-Anon meeting in 1977. I got his mother to go with me, and we went in. It was an Al-Anon speaker, and I thought it was wonderful. I picked up literature. See, I had a name for him now. Before, I thought he was just a sorry drunk. And now alcoholic sounded better to me. So I had a name for it. All right, well, I didn't go but to that one meeting. Then it got time to go to the treatment center. And I went to the treatment center, and I was so excited. And he was still young then, and he cleaned up real good, and he looked good, and he had gained some weight. And, oh, it was just wonderful. It was just going to be great. Well, we did our thing at the treatment center, and we got home, and he got drunk that night. Well, you know what I thought? I got to make him stop drinking. You see, the seed of Al-Anon had been planted. But as long as I'm in control, I don't need anybody else. And I didn't know there was anything wrong with me. And so from 1977 to June of 84, I did not think of Al-Anon and AA as a solution for our problem because I was in the driver's seat. I was running the show. I had not gotten to the point that I thought that we needed any help from anybody. Or at least I didn't need any help. I thought he needed plenty of help. But anyway, so we're going along, and the drinking just continues. It just, as you know, it progresses, and things are getting worse. Well, I decide he needs a psychiatrist, that he's got mental problems. If we could just clear up all these mental problems, then he could get sober. Well, see, I thought I could fix his problems, then he could get sober. Today, I know that he had to get sober before he could do anything about his problems, that I couldn't do anything about them to begin with. But I didn't know that then. So here we go to a psychiatrist. I was working, so I'd take off work. I had the insurance, of course. And I'd drive him to this other town to this psychiatrist on an outpatient basis. And we'd go every week. He'd drink on the way up there. He'd drink on the way back. And he'd go in and talk to the psychiatrist, and I'd wait. Well, this went on week after week after week. Finally, I decided, I'd already told that psychiatrist everything up front, but I decided I need to go back and talk to him again. So one time I was up there, I went in and talked to that psychiatrist, and you know what he said? He said I was the one with a problem. My husband had convinced him that I had a problem. Well, today I know I did, but back then I didn't know I did, and it made me mad as fire, and he didn't go back to that psychiatrist. There was one other time I decided to put him in a mental health, psych ward in a regular hospital for 7 days. And I put him in there, and when he got out, he looked at me and he said, "If you ever put me anywhere else, I'll kill you." And that fear that I'd pushed down inside came back. And I thought, I'll never do anything. See, I was a good martyr. I heard somebody describe themselves when I got into Al-Anon as the three M's: mother, manager, and martyr. Well, I didn't have those children, so I mothered him. He acted like a child, and I treated him like one. And manager, I made the living. I took care of everything. I thought I managed very well. And martyr, people would say, "How in the world can you live with that drunk?" And I'd think I was so wonderful because I was putting up with all that. So I really played the martyr role to the hilt. But I forgot where I was, but it doesn't matter. I'll tell you something else. But anyway, we're just going along. We're going along, and I am getting sicker and sicker and don't even know it. And in 1984, his parents came to me. Oh, I know. I was telling you that I decided I wasn't going to do anything else. That didn't mean that I quit, that I let go and let God. That means that I quit taking him with me everywhere I went. I quit some of the things that I was doing. Of course, I was still trying to get him sober. But anyway, in 84, his parents came to me and said, "We need to get him some help." And I said, "I'm not putting him anywhere." And they said, "Would you talk to him with us?" And see, by this time, we were convinced he needed a psychiatrist, psychiatric help. He just had to get, he had all these emotional problems. And so we decided to talk to him and get him to go see a psychiatrist and go into a treatment for, you know, in a psychiatric treatment place. Well, it was at night and we talked to him and he agreed. But it was going to be the next morning before he went. Well, I knew what he would do. And he did what he was supposed to do that night after his parents left. He went and drank. That's what an alcoholic does. Well, I sat there, and by this time, I had started building walls. I'd built walls up. I did not want to feel. It hurt too bad. I'd gotten where I couldn't laugh, couldn't cry, and I couldn't feel these emotions. That was the only way I could survive. So that night, after he went off to drink, I got to thinking, because this place we were taking him was the same place that his sister was, at the same town that his sister was in the hospital years before. And I thought, I can't take him by myself. I remembered what happened, and I thought, I can't do it. And I started crying. And I had not cried in a long time. And I couldn't quit crying. And I called the preacher that had helped us in 1977. And he said, I can't go. I've got a funeral. He said, but don't go by yourself. Get his parents to go with you. Well, I did get his mother to go. And we went to take him the next day. Of course, he didn't take his beer with his mom in the car. And we got up there, and I told that psychiatrist about all his emotional problems. I'm sure I told him a little about the drinking. And we left him there. And by this time, I really think that I had gotten to the point that I just didn't know if I could go on or not, living as I was living. I was scared. He didn't try to hurt me anymore, but the guns were always there. And he had a 357 Magnum, and he never pointed it at me, but through those drinking years, he would hold it to his head, and I would threaten to leave. I learned after I got in Al-Anon not to do that, to say what you mean and mean what you say. You don't have to say it mean. I had to learn that, too. But I learned that, you know, not to threaten. But then I didn't know that, and I was threatened. So he would hold the 357 Magnum to his head, and he said, if you leave me, I'll blow my brains out. And I would just beg him, please don't, please don't. Well, he'd go out of the house and shoot the gun, and I'd run out there, and I thought he'd killed himself, you know. Well, y'all, this didn't happen just one time. This happened over and over. And one of the times he did it, I thought, I wish you would kill yourself. See, I thought he was my problem. Today, I know that I am my problem. But then I thought he was my problem if he was dead. And in the next breath, I thought, oh, my God, if he kills himself, it'll be my fault because I wished he would. And I was just like that the whole time, just back and forth, crazy. Loving him one minute, hating him one minute, just crazy. But anyway, while he was in this psychiatric unit, they called me and said that they had just opened up an alcohol and drug treatment facility in that same hospital. And they were going to move him. Made me mad as fire. Didn't they know they had to solve all those problems? They did not need to move him over there. See, he'd already been in treatment one time. Of course, they did what they were supposed to do, and they put him in the alcohol and drug unit. And while he was in there, a counselor called me and said, how did I feel about the situation? And I said, well, I think I'm really to the point that I don't think I can live like this any longer. I was really scared again, and I thought, I just can't go on. And he said, are you willing to tell him, you know, that if he doesn't get some help this time, that you're not going to be there? And I said, yes, and I did. Anyway, so I go to the treatment center to get him. And when we get home this time, he had an AA contact. Of course, he did before. He just didn't call him. But he had a contact, and he called an AA member in our hometown. And we started going to meetings. Now, by God, I couldn't get him sober, but I was going to keep him sober. So I was going to every meeting. We were making 90 and 90, you know. Here we go. Off to these meetings. Now, I knew about Al-Anon and AA because I'd been in 1977, and when you go to the treatment center, they took us to outside AA meetings, so I knew about all this stuff now, you know. So he comes home, and we're going. He calls someone, and we go to a meeting that night, and we start going to meetings. Well, the first few meetings we went to were open AA meetings, and I got to sit next to him. Instead of having to go in the Al-Anon room, you see. And we sit there, and they say something I thought he ought to hear. I kind of punch him. Then we'd get in the car to go home, and I was afraid he didn't hear it, so I'd repeat it all to him. I was so sick. One night after two or three nights of going to open AA meetings, I was sitting in this room, and this lady, she kind of had a gruff voice. She came up to me, and she said, I believe you. We were just sitting there drinking coffee before the meeting. I knew I was supposed to go in that other room. But she said, I think you need to be in this other room. I said, I know, I'm coming. And I go in there, and that was my first Al-Anon group, and that was in June of 84. And I went in that meeting, and I want to tell you what I felt. I felt, for the first time in AA and Al-Anon, a lot of love, which I had not felt in a long, long time. There was just something there that I had not felt. And then I felt a lot of hope. Now, when we got in that room, she got our One Day at a Time daily reader out, and she turned to the back of it, and she said, "I believe you need to read these pages on controlling." That woman had just met me. She didn't even know me. And so I did, though. I wanted to do, see, I'm a good little wife now, and we're trying to get sober. I wanted to do everything I could do. Thank God I wanted to do that, even if it was for all the wrong reasons, because I read everything I could get my hands on. And I read everything and just absorbed all this stuff as soon as I got into the program. At first there was hope. My hope was that he'd stay sober. But then there was hope for me regardless of whether he stayed sober or not. So we were going along and he didn't make 90 and 90. One day he came in and I knew he'd been drinking. I didn't want to do what I had done before. That was what was different about me. Always before he would have caught it, if he had come in drinking like that, you know, my behavior would have been the same old thing. I didn't want to do that. And thank God for Al-Anon. Thank God for this program. I wanted to change. He came in, and I did look at him, and I said, because he was trying to hide it, I said, "I know you've been drinking, but you know, I can't do anything about that. That's your problem." And I continued to go to meetings. He would go sometime, you know, drinking, not drinking. But I continued to go to meetings. So I'm going along to meetings, and he's still drinking. And he, all of a sudden, after about, I'd heard in the meetings, you know, don't make any major decisions in the first year. And I'd heard that in AA and in Al-Anon. Well, after about 6 months of going to meetings, his drinking had really progressed again. And he was slinging guns around. He loved dogs. And he shot one of his favorite little dogs right in front of me, trying to make me do what he wanted me to do. And it was just, the guns were in play. But, I mean, he wasn't pointing them at me, but I was scared. So after 6 months in the program, I made the decision to leave. And I left him because we lived on his father's farm, and we didn't have those children. So I just packed my little bags and I left. Now, I was scared, so at first I would not tell him where I was going. I told him I was leaving. I didn't just up and leave. I told him I was leaving. And I left, and I heard, I got a sponsor, which is really important. I got a sponsor right away, and she shared this with me. She said this experience had happened with her one time, and when she told her husband where she was, she told him, "If you come to see me drinking or drunk, I'll call the law." And that's when she told me, "Say what you mean and mean what you say. And if you do it, they'll know you mean it." So when I left, I didn't tell him right away, but eventually I told him where I was, but I said that to him. And I told him if he came, I would call the law. And he believed me. And I meant it. And he knew I meant it. Well, guess what? I stayed separated 9 months, and my pride was hurt. He never came to see me. He would call, sometimes drinking, sometimes not, sometimes cuss me out, sometimes beg me to come back. He would come to where I was and leave something when he knew I was at work, but he wouldn't come because he knew I meant it, and he was drinking the whole time. Well, after 9 months of being separated, I was having a time trying to decide what to do about that marriage. I heard a speaker, an AA speaker, talking about his relationship when he was separated, and he said he prayed for that old thing, and he prayed for himself, and he prayed for their marriage, and he was trying to do the right thing. See, when I left, I was by myself, and I was really, it was a time in my life that I was working this program and trying to do this program. I was down on my knees. I was really wanting God's will to be done and not Linda's. I was really wanting to change. I had a good sponsor. I did a four step. I got right into everything. And y'all know, I was just amazed when I did a fourth step and found out I was a controlling person. I had no idea. I had no idea. And some other character defects that I had, you know, I was just, and my sponsor looked at me when I was telling her how, "I just can't believe I'm like that. And I didn't know I was so bad." She said, "Look, you did the best you could with what you got, what you had." But she said, "Now you know better." And so I'm grateful that she said that to me, because I was really beating myself up really bad. And today I know that I did the best I could, but now I know better. But anyway, I was on my knees and I was praying, and I was asking for God's will to be done, not my will. And I was going along, and I was having a hard time because, see, I was taught that divorce was wrong as I was growing up in the church, and I was still very active in the church, and I just didn't believe it. And so I was having a time trying to decide what to do, so I was praying and asking God, and I couldn't do anything till it was all right between me and God. And finally I got to that point that it was okay with me and with God, that I could do what I had to do. Now, I have to get honest, because this is an honest program. I met this guy in AA, and I wanted to date. Well, I didn't think it was right to date until I was divorced. So I did go ahead and file for divorce, and then, you know, God sometimes does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. That guy that I was after my divorce was final, he decided he didn't want me. And the reason I say that like that, because as I was wanting him and being friends with him, I was talking a lot to my sponsor, and you know who became my sponsor after I divorced and moved? That old woman that told me to read those pages on controllers. And she's the one that, she looked at me and she said, I said, you know, I think this guy, you know, this guy in AA, you know, everybody in AA is not well. Everybody dialed on's not well either. But I was finding all these things that I, you know, this guy, some things needed fixing. They just weren't quite right. And I was telling my sponsor this stuff. And she said, Linda, what do you think you're going to do, change him? Now, I've been in the program just long enough to know I couldn't change anybody else. I said, no, I just think I'll be a good influence on him. She said, you better look at that. And I realized what I was doing was the same thing I had always done before. See, I needed to be needed. I needed somebody that needed me to fix them and help them. And I was really looking for somebody like that again. And I'm grateful that God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and that guy didn't want me. But anyway, I'm going along, and I'm really working on myself at this time. My sponsor got me very active in service work. We started going to a lot of AA weekends and Al-Anon weekends and going to all these things. And in 1985, my sponsor introduced me to a man named Rip Smith. He was sober in AA, and we were at one of these conferences or roundups, and she introduced me to him. Well, I was kind of still after that other guy. He was younger and cuter, you know, and I wasn't ready to give up. But anyway, at first, I just met this Rip, and we became friends. I really liked him, but I really didn't want him, you know. But anyway, we just became friends, and we'd see each other at assemblies, and we'd see each other at these weekends, and once in a while he'd call. But for over a year, we just were friends. Well, in May of 86, we were at one of these conferences, and he asked me, he lived about 70 miles from me, and he asked me could he come see me. And I said, well, I didn't have anybody at that time, so I said, yeah. So he came to see me, and 6 months later, we were married. I really liked him, you know, I really liked him, and I really fell in love with him, and he was a wonderful, wonderful person, great personality, and just the love of my life. He was my knight in shining armor. Now, I would have told you, I'd been in the program maybe 2 years at that time, and he had like 3 years or more sobriety. And I would have told you that fantasy was gone. You know, here I was, I'm 40 years old at that time, and I'm getting married again. And, you know, that fantasy's gone. And I'm into reality because I'm into this program. No, that's not true. We get married, but, you know, that fantasy's not gone. He's my knight in shining armor, and we're going to have that little white house with the picket fence, and we're going to have those children, and we're going to live happily ever after. Well, he had two children. He was a little bit older than me. He had two children in their 20s, and like I said, I was 40, but we talked about having children, and he knew how badly I wanted them. So he said, why don't we leave it in God's hands? So I got pregnant on the honeymoon. I didn't even know I was pregnant. I lost that one when I was just 6 weeks. But that's how I thought, okay, you know, I could get pregnant. I didn't know I could. I never had been. So I really worked hard and enjoyed it for the next 2 years trying to get pregnant. Because I really wanted a child, and I was getting older, you know. So we're going along, and we're really into service work. He's in service work in AA, and I'm in service work in Al-Anon, and we're going to a lot of meetings and doing a lot of things. And he gets hurt. He was a railroad man, and he got hurt at the railroad and couldn't work anymore. And about that time, I turned up pregnant again. I'm 52 years old, and I find out that I'm pregnant. And I am just so excited. I'm just so excited. He's okay with it, but he's not really ecstatic, but I was. I was just so happy. Well, I carried that baby 3 months, and I lost that child. And my world fell apart. The program that I would have told you at that time that I had a pretty good program. I had a good conscious contact with the God of my understanding. I was going to meetings. I was very active. I was sponsoring the Alteen group. I was doing all this stuff. I would have told you I had a good program and a good conscious contact with God. But when this happened, I got angry. I had never gotten angry with God through all the drinking, through all the things. But I got angry with God. One night we were laying in the bed, and Rip, I was just crying, carrying on. And Rip looked at me, and he said, "Linda, you know, I think you might need to look at this. I think you're angry with God." And I thought, me? No, I'm not angry with God. And in the next breath, I thought, "God, why did you let me get pregnant if you were going to take my baby?" And I realized I was angry with God. Well, when I got angry with God, I got angry with everybody. I didn't want to be around anybody. I was mad at Rip. I was mad at the world. All of you and AA and Al-Anon, nothing was right. I did two things right. Thank God I did two things right. I kept going to meetings. I'd sit in those meetings. I'd just scowl at you, you know. I didn't even want to be there, but I knew to go. So I'd sit in those meetings, but I didn't like it. And I would call my sponsor, and I would cry, and she would let me, and I would carry on. Well, I heard somebody say in one of those meetings that what they did, that they prayed every morning before they got out of bed, that when their eyes opened, that they started praying. Because if their foot touched the floor, their mouth came open and I identified. So I started trying to pray that way. See, it's okay to pray even if you're angry with God. I still believed. And I began to pray that way. And I began to pray a little differently than I prayed before. I began to pray more and thanking God for what I did have before I asked for His will to be done in my life that day. And so I started doing that. Maybe it was just a habit at first, but it became a good habit, and I still do it today. I wake up, the first thing I think of is God. I pray before I get out of bed, and thank God that I learned to do that. Well, I kept going to meetings. We kept going and doing things, and I began to get better. I began to get that conscious contact back, even more of a conscious contact than I'd ever had with God as we went along. And so, excuse me, my mouth's so dry, excuse me. So Rip and I are going along good, and you know how good God is. I couldn't have those children. He gave me a grandbaby. Right after that, Rip's son and his wife had a little girl, and I've got to be grandma. Now, one reason I was angry with Rip, I wanted to try again, but he didn't want me to, so I never could have those children. But I have that grandchild in my life today, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to have her. She's 6 years old. Anyway, so we're going along, and things are getting better, and Rip's building a relationship back with his kids with his sobriety, and they're at our house a lot, and even his ex-wife, their mother's at our house some, and, you know, we've just got it good. Everything's good. We've got a really good marriage, and the best thing we've got going for us is we're still friends. We are best friends in this marriage. Now, it wasn't always great. Rip used to tell this. Sometimes he said, if I was doing what I was supposed to do, working my program, and Linda was working her program, everything was fine. Say she wasn't working hers and I was working mine, everything was fine. Or if I wasn't working mine and she was working hers, everything was fine. But he said, oh, those days when neither one of us were working a program. And that's how they would be those days sometimes, but thank God they didn't last very long. But we had a wonderful, wonderful marriage. Well, we're going around and Rip speaking. He spoke at Gratitude Weekend here at Myrtle Beach, and I think it was 92. And we're beginning to go all over the United States in different places, and we're speaking, and we just got the world by the tail. And see, what I started doing was thanking God for what I had instead of crying over what I didn't have. The fantasy was gone. I realized that what I was grieving for when I lost that child, I was grieving that for the loss of the child, but I was also grieving for the loss of the dream, the loss of the fantasy. It couldn't be. I couldn't have those kids, you know. But you know what? God gave me so much more. He gave me so much more. I had so many people in my life that I was finding at that time, and so many friends in AA and Al-Anon, and life was so good. So we're going along, and in July of 1996, my world really did fall apart. Rip was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and I thought, what am I going to do? I can't do this, God. I can't do this. We were going to doctors, and they told him that he asked, and they told him that he probably had about 6 months. Now, I got to tell you that I'm the kind, you know, I tell you about those masks I used to wear and those roles I used to play and those acts I put on. I was the kind that I thought, okay, I got to pull it together now. I got to be strong for him. I've got to do this. And so I tried to be the cheerleader. I tried to get everybody okay. If he got down, I had to be up, you know. I had to be okay through it all. He was the kind, though, and I got to tell you this about him. Thank God for the program that man had. Somebody said about him after he died, they said, you know, Rip showed us how to live. He had a program, he had a wonderful AA program. And he said, now what he's doing is showing us how to die. And that's exactly what he did. It was a steady flow of people from the time he was diagnosed, he got sick, a steady flow of AA and Al-Anon people in our home for those 6 months, all the time. And they would come in, and some of them that he sponsored, and he worked with so many alcoholics, they would come in and say, why you, Rip? He'd say, why not me? Why not me? And I'd say, oh, but Rip, we got to pray for healing. He said, Linda, just pray for God's will. Just pray for God's will. It's going to be okay. And I said, but Rip, he's already done one miracle. You're sober. He can do another miracle. And he said, I know. Just pray for God's will. And he handled it so beautifully. But anyway, going through that, I could not pray for God's will and mean it. Because I knew from what the doctor said that he's probably, and as he got sicker and sicker and as we went along through the 6 months, I knew that he probably was going to die. And it was hard. I could not pray for God's will. I didn't want him to die. I knew I needed to. Well, as we went along, I finally asked God to help me to be reconciled to his will. And I began to accept that God knew what was best. My husband was getting, if anybody knows people that die with cancer, they just get weaker, got weaker and weaker and weaker and lost a lot of weight and all of that. And he was in a lot of pain. He had, well, it was lung cancer, but by the time it was diagnosed, it was in his bones, and that's very, very painful. And he was in a great deal of pain. And he was really suffering. And so anyway, I finally got to the point that I could accept and really pray and mean it when I wanted God's will to be done, even if it meant that he would not be with me, that he would go on and be with God. Anyway, on January 26, 1996, he died in my arms in our bed. And let me tell you about that. I didn't want to let him go. But let me tell you, God was right there with us. God had been with us through the 6 months, or we could not have dealt with it like we did. And he sent angels. You were all angels. All the AAs and Al-Anons, they were there for us. But that morning, I was right there with him. And they had told us that it could be really awful when he went out. You know, I mean, they described what could happen. But it didn't. You know why it didn't? Because God was there. God was there, and he just took a breath, and then he didn't breathe. And he took another breath, and he didn't breathe. He was so peaceful. And I know that God just took him home in his arms right there. Well, I fell apart, but I got to pull it together because people came to the house right after he died. They knew instantly. And the house was full, and everybody came, and they were so wonderful, the support that I had, that we had, and that I had after he died. We had his funeral, and then everybody left. Everybody left, except a good friend that came with me, and I'm grateful she came with me this weekend, Connie, a good Al-Anon friend of mine, and one of my sisters was still there for a couple of days, but then they had to go. And I was all alone. I thought, God, I can't do this. I can't do this. I wanted to die. I did not want to live. I thought, I can't do this. It's just too hard. Well, a good friend of mine from Mississippi sent me this poem, and she personalized it like it was a letter from heaven from Rip. And I can't quote it, but it said something like, Dear Linda, it's so bright and beautiful here, and all the struggling and pain is over, and how wonderful it'll be when you're here with me, and how deeply I love you. And there was one line that stood out, and it said, But your work is not finished yet. But one day you'll be here with me, and how beautiful that will be. Well, that stood out to me because, see, I didn't want to live. I wanted to die. But that stood out to me, and I thought, well, God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? And I don't know what God wants me to do except to do his will and to do what he would have me to do. And I know for me that is to be of maximum service to God and to my fellow man. So I just put one foot in front of the other, and I kept trying to do what I was supposed to do. I went to meetings. I had to work, thank God, because if I hadn't, I'd have just pulled the covers over my head and just quit living if I could have. But I couldn't do that. I had to get out. I had to work, and I went to meetings, and I was very involved with working with people, in the, especially family members in the program. So I kept going to meetings, and I kept hearing people saying, you know, God does this. I'll go to several different meetings, and the same thing will be said, because God knows I need to hear it. But it kept being said that God won't lead you where his grace can't sustain you. And I heard that over and over at meetings, and I know that's true. God was with me. You know, the footprints in the sand? All during that time, I know that there was only one set of footprints, and the reason for that is God was carrying me because I could not do it myself. He was carrying me. I was speaking after that, about a year after that, or 6 months, 9 months, something after that, and I said to people, I said, you know, God was carrying me, but I believe he's put me down, and I wish he'd pick me back up. But, you know, I know today what he does. He does put us down to walk by his side and hold his hand. And that's what he does. He never lets me go. I walk by his side and I hold his hand, and that's how I make it. And when it gets too difficult, he picks me back up again, and he carries me. And that's what God is doing for me today. I try to pray and ask God, what do you want me to do? You know that prayer that I started saying? Thank God I started saying that when Rip died. I have not had to get angry with God. I've not gotten angry with God. Because after the baby died and I started praying that way and thanking God for what I have every day since Rip died, and it's almost been 3 years now, I have thanked God for the time I had with him. And that has kept me from just crying and carrying on and going on because he's not here. I know I have to go on. My time is not up yet. So I just asked God, what would you have me to do? And I put one foot in front of the other, and I keep going. Well, anyway, I've got to hurry along. But anyway, that was in 1996. I made it through that year with the help of God and my friends. And the pain was still great. And almost a year after that, I was diagnosed with cancer. And I thought my reaction would be so different. But you know what my reaction was? It's okay. It's okay. It's okay, maybe, God, I can go on and be with Rip. That's how I reacted to having cancer. Of course, in the next breath, I thought, God, just take me on. I don't want to suffer. I didn't want to hurt. But because I'd watched my mother die when she was 55 years old with cancer, and then I'd gone through, watched Rip die with cancer and others. But anyway, God was so good to me. Again, he's not through with me yet, because I had breast cancer. They caught it so early that they removed both breasts, and I did not even have to have I didn't have to have chemotherapy or radiation therapy. I just had reconstructive surgery, And as far as I know, I'm fine. So, you know, God is so good to me, but he's just not finished with me yet. So I'm going along, and I'm still grieving, but the pain's getting a little less, to the point that I don't want to die. You know, I still wanted to die. I think this year, and it'll soon be 3 years, that this is the first year that I really want to wake up and live, that I want to go on living. It's a process, and I think it takes time, a lot of times, to grieve and to go through what you have to go through. But I think I'm finally to the point. Well, anyway, when 1998 rolled around, I was almost scared, but I said, okay, God, what's going to happen this year? And then I thought, say that, Linda. So the 98's been going along fine, and I'm going to close pretty soon, but I just want to tell you this. In October, I got a call, and my first husband, the active alcoholic that I'd lived with, was found dead at his house. He died drunk. He died from alcoholism. He could not get sober. He had tried. He had been to treatment when I was there, and he had been to some AA, I understand, from other people during that time. I kept in touch. I didn't see him through the years, but I kept in touch with his family. What a waste of such a good life. You know, I forget how powerful alcoholism is. You know what, and I forget how powerful it is for me to, and I forget how powerless I am. I went back. I had never made direct amends to that man. Changing my behavior was a lot of amends, but I had never made direct amends to that man. And I was able to do that. He was dead, but I was able to do that when I went to his funeral. He had never remarried or anything. And I was a part of that family still, and I went to the funeral. But I was able to make my amends to him. But my thought was, I went to, with his mother and his sister, I went to his house to get some things and after the funeral. And you know what my thinking was? I don't care how many years I've been in this program, I know that I can still get that stinking thinking. I can still be go back to thinking the way I did before. My thinking was, Linda, you should have gone back and done something after Rip died. You should have helped that. Helped your first husband. You should have done something. I forget how powerless I was. I couldn't fix him when I was there. I couldn't have fixed him if I'd have gone back. You know, I have to truly admit how powerless I am over alcoholism and how powerful alcoholism is. Everybody does not make it to these rooms. You're miracles sitting out there. We're miracles. The Al-Anons too. If we make it to these rooms, because there's so many people that don't. And he didn't make it. And I grieved, and I was surprised. You know, I never hated him. I didn't know I had loved him like I did. I've grieved since he died. But you know what I know today? That I didn't hate him, and that I did love him, and that I will have to grieve for him. And I grieved that he could not find what we found. He was a good person. And there's so many out there that never find it. Anyway, like I said, I don't know what I'm doing half the time with my life now, except that I just, people ask me, they crazy enough to ask me to come speak. I'm crazy enough to say yes. And I just keep going and trying to do what I think God's will is for me, and that's to help other people. And maybe there's somebody here that got some help from this today. I hope that there is. This is something that I always close my talk with that I would like to close with today, and I wish and I hope and pray that I can get to the point that I can feel this way and that I can live this way more and more as I progress in this program. This is the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console. To be understood as to understand. To be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. God bless you.
Thank you.